Welcome to Season 4, Episode 5 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk a little bit about what I consider one of the lesser-known greats, or some of you may not know, Dave Hargrave. And we decide to discuss a little bit about narrative combat. Again, welcome to Season 4, Episode 5 of RPG Circus. My name is Jeff. Joining me this week is Brian from GamerAssembly.com.
Hey,
unfortunately,
everybody.
Marshall didn't show up. We weren't able to get a hold of him. So there's only two of us this week, but that's okay. I think we have some interesting stuff, to say the least.
Yeah, we got some stuff for you.
Yeah, and we have a little idea for our next episode, which is, GamerAssembly.net.
It's .net. It is. I don't think .com will go anywhere.
Yeah. I'm sorry, people. GamerAssembly.net. Why did it was a .com?
It was probably me editing the Stuffer Shack link. I'm still with Stuffer Shack, but Gamer Assembly is going to be at PAX East. Don't forget. I want you to remember, people. Now we can move on.
See, we had to explain what's going on here. Well, I don't really have much, so want to just head off into the news?
Let's do the news.
Okay, the news. First news item was, which I thought was a little interesting, was this, where is it here? Purple Pawn apparently did a little gamer survey. And I guess he's done this every year. Which was actually kind of, and it's interesting because it's a comparison of entrepreneurship of the hobby, the gamer hobby in general, versus other entrepreneurs in terms of like their failure rates, success rates.
Okay.
And what was interesting was that he had 391 respondents from 35 countries and 39 U.S. states. What was interesting was that he says 2011 apparently was much like 2010. Of those companies that didn't close, the overwhelming majority of them are doing fine or even better than last year, with only 13% reporting doing worse than last year.
Okay.
So for me, that's good news.
Yeah.
And he said,
go ahead.
And he said, you know, normal things, normal top performing games can turn upward. Surprisingly, Magic the Gathering, I don't know. I've never been a Magic player. I'm sometimes surprised that game still exists, but people seem to like it.
I am under the impression that Magic the Gathering is a large majority of WotC's income.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me. I mean, it always has been.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the reasons that WotC was able to buy TSR back in the day. So, let's see. Catan, which makes sense.
Yeah.
Dominion and Warhammer and Pathfinder products outperformed Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition by a factor 2-1.
Yeah.
Wow. So
who's Purple Pawn? What is Purple Pawn?
You never heard of him? He runs a rather famous blog/website.
No, I have no idea who this Purple Pawn gentleman is.
Yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
I can't pronounce his name. I'm going to mispronounce it. God, I'm just going to call him Mr. Berlinger because I can't pronounce his first name. I actually met him at Gen Con 2009, but I cannot pronounce his name. I'm sorry.
So he's just a blogger. He's not like in, you know, in distribution or anything. This is just something that he's done as an interest.
Right.
Is that correct?
For several. I mean, he runs basically a major news game site.
Yep.
So that's what he does. And the reason I can't pronounce his first name is I don't know if it's Yiddish or something. I don't know where the name comes from specifically, but I know it's I'm sorry, people. I can't even pronounce my own name sometimes, so there you go for that. But no, I mean, it was interesting, you know, that he's done these surveys like every year. And the interesting thing is the closure rates compared to purpose, which resulted in 50%. So basically, you know, I guess he was talking about in 2011, there was, from based on his survey alone, obviously, there was a 7.5% closure rate. But in 2010, there was a 40% closure rate. And he's the most interesting thing in here, which is what I kind of always suspected over the time, is it said that the it seems the hobby industry performs worse than other entrepreneurships in tougher times, but better as the economy improves. Well, that doesn't. I mean, that doesn't surprise me. You know, that makes a warped kind of sense because it all has to do with disposable currency. When the economy is doing poor, us gamers don't have disposable currency that we can pay for something.
Yep.
And when we when the economy is doing better, we kind of have more money. So that's kind of I thought that was kind of interesting overall.
Yeah. No, I mean, it sort of makes sense. I don't not too surprised by it.
No, I'm not either. But, you know, it's just one of those things. This other one kind of is an interesting, how do I put this? It's both sad that this kind of thing happens, and on the other hand, it's not surprising, but there is a, apparently a game store was going out of business, and this was in, Asheville, North Carolina. This is North Carolina, which we'll get to some more North Carolina people later on. And it was interesting that, you know, the inventory was snatched up by a gaming entrepreneur who announced that he was going to start a score called The Wyvern's Tale. Okay. Now, this is all on any news if anyone wants to act, not any news, any world, if anyone wants to check it. We'll include the show links for this. Because there are some interesting tidbits here and there. And apparently, the rival card game store, Hillside Games, registered a few domains that had, you know, was called the wyvernstale.com, .net, .info, and .mobi.
Yep.
And, you know, then this whole thing went about, you know, well, you know, because it's like, is it ethical to do that? And, you know, what can you, you know, what can you do? At this time, the last word that they put out, which is that they've decided to just, what? They have some sort of weird, they have, they decided to register some other odd, weird domain, the Wyverns. Tail, A-Y-L. I don't know if that's right.
I mean, I hadn't gotten that far on the story. I know I heard you know, there was a bit of back and forth between the two stores. I mean, one store doesn't even exist yet. He, the guy who bought up the inventory, sort of announced it on the internet that this is what he was going to do.
Right,
and then, you know, within 24 hours, all of a sudden the domains were gone.
Right, which. Honestly, I say if you have an idea and you are going to announce it, you might as well buy the domains first.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, I've done that. And if you don't use the domains, usually, honestly, this day and age, domain registration is cheap. Yep. And when I mean cheap, people complain, oh, domain registrations is $10, $12, $13. Huh. I got news for you. Back when I first registered my first domain, you know what it cost per year?
What did it cost?
$95.
I believe it.
Or was that for five or something? There was a price. well, you got to remember, that was a long time ago, and there was only one company you could register domains through. You know, so not like today where you can register a domain with anyone, practically. But no, they. It's interesting, though, because the wyvernstale.com and wyvernstale.com redirect to a website dedicated to professional miniature painter. That's what Hillside is apparently done for now. So,
yeah, there was definitely some harsh words. At one point, the other game store, and I can't remember their name for the life of me, got their lawyer involved. And
Hillside Games.
Yeah, Hillside Games. Thank you.
Yeah.
And it's just been a mess.
Well, I know that's because they were claiming liable on the other company.
Yeah, Yeah, which, come on, please. It was just a mess, and it was unprofessional. And I mean, I feel bad for the guy that did it. Apparently, said some nasty things and emotionally. And then later, I think he retracted most of the nasty things he said. But the Hillside doesn't seem to be backing down. Frankly, at this point, the store doesn't exist. I would have just picked a cool name, something else, and ran with it.
Yeah, it's kind of stupid overall.
You kind of want to see people bounce back from this. If this is going to stop you from making your store, it doesn't make me terribly confident. I feel bad for the guy, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah, it's kind of a stupid story in a way, but it's just this kind of stuff happens, and you're just mm-hmm. and for me the problem is, it's like, you know, I live in an area where, surprisingly, I mean, there are several game stores here in the Phoenix metro area, but considering our population, there's not as many as I would have hoped there would have been.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when I hear of one going out of business and another one trying to start up, you know, you're just like, okay, well, you know, that's kind of keeping the status quo.
Yep.
And I mean, from the one article, it seemed like Hillside Games is primarily a card game store.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking, you know, I guess CCGs.
That's what the impression I received was.
So in some ways, they're not exactly competition, unless that's what you know, the Wyvern's Tale is going to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Because, you know, there's a lot of play in when you say game store.
Yeah, I mean, it could be anything. And a lot of those places, even if they favor one, tend to sell the other as well. So,
right.
I mean, I can understand why people might feel like it's competent, like it's a threat.
Yeah, it's just still, I mean, I'm just going to say this whole situation was stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And both parties didn't act completely intelligently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I had been the Wyvern's Tale guy, I would have not announced something before I had the domains. That's just me.
Sure. I mean, everybody makes mistakes, but you know, even after that, there's other things he could have done.
Right. And, you know, some people pointed that out. There's other domains that he could have gotten that was fairly close. You know, he could have done something with a hyphen. The problem gets to be, you know, the issue is if someone goes to one site and not the other.
Yep.
You know, it's like when whitehouse.com used to be a porn site.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, one of those type of things. So it was just kind of stupid. We actually got two interesting ones about Kickstarter. Actually, three, right?
Three, yeah.
Three. Let's go with the more interesting one first. There's a new site called RPG Kickstarter. I mean, that's the title of it. Well, I'll have a link in the show notes, because it's actually a Tumblr site.
Uh-huh.
So, but it's what it's trying to do is trying to gather up all the RPG-related Kickstarter projects and present them.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, I like the idea of that, because God knows there's a ton of them on Kickstarter.
There's a ton. And Kickstarter can be very difficult to navigate at times, so it doesn't separate the RPG games itself. All the games are sort of together.
Right. And especially since there's a lot more RPGs today that are going the Kickstarter route for projects.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're Palladium, and then you just create your own.
Yeah. Successfully, mind you, so I shouldn't laugh too much.
Hey, if it works for them, you know, I'm happy for them. But that just, wow, that seems like a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what we're talking about here. So that's kind of a cool thing. We have the link in the show notes. So that way, if you want to keep an eye on RPG-related Kickstarters, which obviously I do, I don't know about you. You know, I may not do anything with them, but I like, because it's like I always seem to find out about the Kickstarters way later than I should.
It would be nice to know what's going on, absolutely.
So, you know, and since they have an RSS feed, put that in your RSS feed reader and launch that puppy every morning, and hey, you know what's going on. So, the other one is that there is a Kickstarter project that is, I think, is very cool for a... It's from Paul Hughes,
mm-hmm.
and he did an old. It's kind of for AD&D, really. It's kind of old school, but it encapsulates the old Advanced Dungeons and Dragons Dungeon Master's Guide Random Dungeon Generator.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. and it's like on a poster. It's a illustrated 36-inch by 24-inch playable dungeon map poster.
Yeah.
Which the sample, I guess, that they have in the corner looks kind of cool. I might actually have to do this one because that's just kind of funny.
Mm-hmm.
And
this isn't his first big RPG poster either. He had a couple other ones linked where it was, you know, the random encounter chart as a giant.
Yes.
Posters.
He has the random encounter chart, right. And what's very interesting, though, is that if you pledge $22 or more, you get a signed poster. And you'll get one bonus poster, either a second random dungeon poster or the Wandering Monster poster.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not bad. You could get both for $22 or so.
Yep.
And he has some other levels. If you're a 4E person, at the $25 or more pledge, you get a signed poster and 10 Monster Manual on a Business Card business cards, which contains the complete math for creating 4th edition monsters.
Yeah, it's sounds like Sly Flourish has a DM cheat sheet, which he managed to get on a business card as well. So it sounds just like a truncated version of that.
Yeah, so that's kind of some cool stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's some cool stuff out there. And I just brought it up because it's like I kind of... And I guess they're also going to include stickers. Anybody that puts over $23 will get about a dozen stickers with the five heroes that he has on the on the random dungeon map poster. Which is, I don't know, I always like stickers. I tend to put them on my laptops. Oh, trust me. I have an RPG Circus sticker on my laptop. I have an SDF sticker for SDFLoneStar.org, which is the public free shell account system, mm-hmm. Unix system. So, you know, I have I have my geek stuff, if you will.
Sure.
So that's why I like stickers, for that. So I mean, this one looks interesting. I definitely need art, especially since I'm starting to finish up my gaming cave. You know, I have a garage that's too narrow to actually put my car in. Don't ask how mm-hmm. that worked, but it's a perfect space. It even has an AC vent in my garage.
Yeah.
So it's almost like an extra room. So I've been kind of slowly getting stuff, putting stuff in there. I have to still get an actual real table that I'm going to use to game on in there.
But,
you know, rather than use the kitchen table, we can go out there and game. And, you know, you can leave stuff set up that way. So I need something to decorate out there. So something like this would be pretty cool for that.
Okay.
You're laughing, aren't you?
I am. I'm laughing at you. I'm sorry.
It's not that funny. So let's see what else. And let's see. The other one that we got is the one that you brought up, which was this Mobile Frame Zero.
That's right. Mobile Frame Zero : Rapid Attack. I guess it's the 10th anniversary edition of Vincent Baker's Mechaton. But I don't know this game. This is apparently an older game system. It's only 10 years old. That was relatively popular. But the interesting thing about this Kickstarter is there's still a ton of time left. There's 29 days to go. They're, you know, $3,000 over their pledge. And it's basically the rough idea behind the game is you build little robots out of Legos, and that's what you use as your minis. It's like a little war game, but you can build a setting around it and turn it into an RPG. What brought this to my attention is he's been doing so well. He's, you know, well over his goal. He's decided that if he gets to $15,000, which is less than $3,000 away, and he's got a month to go, he's just going to release it Creative Commons. So you'll still get all your normal, you know, physical versions or, you know, nice PDF of the rules for backing it. But if he gets that far, everybody gets it. And when stuff like that happens, I think it's great. You know, Kickstarter is nice. It's nice that we can get these small RPGs into the hands of people who want them. But if it is so successful that you can get it in the hands of everybody, the community benefits. It's fantastic. So if you're into that kind of game, I definitely recommend checking it out.
Yeah, that's... That sounds kind of cool. You know, it's like I have to say that's one of the things that I really love about Kickstarter is the fact that it allows some of what I would consider the smaller publishers or people who might want to self-publish something but don't quite have the funds. It allows them to see if there's enough interest in the product that they're trying to produce to actually get it out there.
Sure. I would have been surprised if I had seen something like this in my local game store. But obviously he had enough interest to publish the book. You know, Kickstarter lets you prove those things. It's great.
Yeah, and that's what's great about these, because if there's not enough interest, then you're not out a whole bunch of money to produce it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because that's, especially anything that requires physical books, that's not very cheap to do.
No.
I don't know if you've ever looked into that. I have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and trust me, because like going the Lulu route isn't quite as great as it sounds.
It's funny that you say that. So the Gamer Assembly, we've been working on some print-on-demand publications. Recently, what we did was this thing called the Call to Assembly. I don't know if we ever talked about it on here.
No, I don't think we have.
It's basically a gaming magazine that we put together.
Oh, yes, we did. I'm sorry.
There's very little gaming magazines out there. And we put it out for free in PDF so you can grab it. And then we did print-on-demand for basically the cost of it is to print it according to Lulu. And it's not a very big magazine. I think the first issue was 36 pages. And if you're going to buy it on Lulu, it's $8. Compare that to Cobalt Quarterly, which is either $8 or $9. They recently had a price increase by a dollar or two. And it's well over 100 pages with custom art, you know, famous designers, all this other stuff. It's the cost ratio is just getting way blown up because you're going through Lulu and you're getting these small batch printing and it's not like there's a lot of better sites out there, and Lulu's just
not really for print on demand. You'd have to go through a more traditional printer,
which means you're going to have to print up at least
a certain number of copies. That's definitely a thing that people don't understand about the printing industry. It's not as easy to print. I mean, there is Lulu to do print-on-demand, but it costs a certain amount because it's a print-on-demand service.
It's print-on-demand.
Yeah. So there you go. Anything else in the Kickstarter arena?
No, not Kickstarter. I think we're good.
And the last thing we're going to cover is Paizo announced their top four for... where did I put that? Hey, I don't have the Paizo top four. That really sucks. But Paizo did announce their, it actually announced today, you know, about four or five hours ago, actually, for us.
Yep.
And, there it is. It was a hidden tab on my computer. That's the only problem with tabs. It's like, where's my thing?
It was very sneaky.
Yep, it was very sneaky. And we have four actual winners, and three of them are from North Carolina.
Yeah.
And two of them are actually from Raleigh, North Carolina. You know, I don't know what the odds are on that, but that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
We have Steve Miller from Raleigh, North Carolina. We have, I'm going to mispronounce this guy's name horribly, James Olchek.
That's how I'd say it.
From Raleigh, North Carolina. Tom Phillips from Fleming Island, Florida. And Mike Wilhelm from Kernersville, North Carolina.
New Kernersville.
Yeah. See, if I don't know I'm terrible at pronouncing names. That's one of the things that really stumbles me in when I game master. If I don't invent the name of the place myself, I can't pronounce it. It's just that simple. So all four of these people actually completed the design and encounter map.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty cool. So they've designed a wondrous item. They've designed an organization. They've created a monster with a stat block, and they've designed an encounter with map.
Yep.
So the final task, which is actually their entries are due on
the 23rd.
The 23rd of this month. It's going to be to submit a Pathfinder module adventure proposal. Wow, I don't know. I definitely know I would have never made it to through the wondrous item myself, but definitely an adventure proposal, a little out of my league, I think.
Hey, it's great exposure, though. Even the people who make it to the top four often go on to doing some stuff the very next year because it's a lot of exposure. And
oh, yeah.
It's a big deal to I mean, it's hundreds of people throw their name in the hat. So the fact that you made it to the top 32, never mind the top four, is just fantastic. Great for them.
Exactly. So that's pretty cool. I'm happy for them, and it will be very interesting to see who wins, and the winner will be announced on the 3rd of April.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. I have no idea if we have a show that day or not, but we'll see. One way or the other, we'll announce it, most of you guys will probably just go ahead and look it up online. So, any other last news items that I forgot? I think we covered everything.
We're good.
Okay, well, here's where it gets interesting. We are going to talk. First topic, of course, is, I don't know, I'm going to talk a little bit about a gentleman who is no longer with us. He died back in, I believe, 88. Let's see. Yep, 1988. But his name was Dave Hargrave. Most people might not know the name, but they probably know if they were a gamer during the early days of the 70s, the early 80s of D&D.
Mm-hmm.
They probably recognize the product that he created, which was called Arduin. I think I heard that pronounced right. And it's interesting because it was a strange product for the time because originally there was just the trilogy. There was he had three basic books, volume one, the Arduin Grimoire, volume one, volume two, volume three.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the original trilogy that he had. And it was kind of interesting because at the time, it's hard to explain. People weren't quite sure whether it was a supplement to D&D,
yep,
or not, or if it was a supplement, if it was a game all upon its own. Because if it was a game all on its own, there were certain things that seemed to be missing.
Yeah.
But definitely, it was a setting that was very high. A lot of players in that era talk about the high mortality rate of PCs.
Yep.
Definitely a very high entropy rate here. You know, he definitely had multi-universe, settings. And it was actually interesting because he was one of the first people to actually, I won't say cross-genre stuff, but it was like he kind of threw everything in the mix. So while there was a heavy, medieval fantasy stuff going on, he had some science fiction elements in his games and his settings. And actually, the interesting thing about it is that the original material was just stuff that people wanted copies of.
Sure.
Many people kind of consider that people either loved him or hated him. That was kind of the attitude as a game master. That was his the thing that people brought to the table is that he apparently at times he had kind of bad personality kind of to some people. I guess that's the way to kind of put it nicely. But what was interesting though is that again this is. He brought a lot of stuff to the table that really hadn't been done before.
Mm-hmm.
He had classes that were not normal. It's like, I think he was one of the first people to ever introduce an alchemist class, for example, in his material.
Sure.
He had like martial artists, he had merchants, which especially for, if you were just playing D&D at the time, you might run into a merchant, but that wasn't a class.
Sure.
These were things that, people didn't have before, and he had the courtesan class. And then what was interesting, I would have to say probably the one race that he had, that he created, I'm sure it was based off something, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Firent. It's weird, it begins with a PH. We always assumed it was an F sound. Was kind of a strange cross between a grasshopper and a mantis humanoid.
Okay.
That were logical. So think Mr. Spock. kind of attitude. And actually, sure. I think in the original description, that's how they kind of describe them. You know, and so, and then of course he had some stuff that were based on, you know, loosely based on, he had Diodans, which was kind of loosely based on Jack Vance's Diodans.
Sure.
And some other things. And even, he even had his own version of the Green Martians from Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, Martian series.
Uh-huh.
Which was kind of, which is kind of interesting. But, you know, he had very inventive things. But the funny thing is that, you know, as you know, new players, we always looked at his material, you know, especially in that era, and we're just like, it was so far out of bounds from what you were used to.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't even, you're just like, really? This is what he's doing, you know? You know, he had things like, you know, because I remember, you know, as a D&D player, you're like, oh my God, I roll up my starting money and I have like 100 gold pieces and I can't buy anything. Whereas, you know, in his variant, if you will, I'm going to call it a variant, he had things like, well, you gain like 5 pieces of equipment as, you know, as like, you know, family heirlooms kind of thing.
Sure. Like background.
Well, kind of like background. Yeah. And then, you know, so that was like, wow, that's the first time that ever came up. Or the other thing that we always, there were these tables that you could roll on to generate, like, if you were a fighter type, there was a table for fighter types for, like, special abilities that you might have. And there was, like, one for the magic users. And at the time, that was completely unheard of. You know, it's like, if you were a fighter, you were a fighter, you know. Basically, you didn't have any skills, you know, you didn't have any special abilities, that was it. But lo and behold, sure. Now, not only do you have a special ability, there's several different special abilities that you might actually randomly get.
Mm-hmm.
So that was unheard of at the time. You know, and like I said, this is where, I mean, even in one of his books, he attacked the whole hit point problem that we've discussed before, I think, on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, you know, a first level fighter and a 20th level fighter, the hit point differences between the two might be only like 15 or 20 hit points. You know?
Yep.
And it's like, you know, you could have a first level fighter fighting back to back against, you know, a 20th level fighter. Of course, the 20th level fighter is going to hit more, but that's, you know, it's kind of beside the point.
Sure.
And what's really interesting, though, is that his work is still, you know, the concept of his work is still being actually published today.
Mm-hmm.
There is actually still a company that actually makes his material. It's called Emperor's Choice. They actually still release some Arduin material. I think the latest version of the system is the Arduin Eternal set. And let me tell you, the price tag is no joke. 74, almost like $75, and it's a hardcover book.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, but it's still out there. And they even release basically his Game World notes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called KHAAS, KHAAS.
Mm-hmm.
But they have his notes for that too, and we'll include the links to in the show notes to those type of interests. But I mean, I bring this up just because, you know, it's like everyone knows who Gary Gygax is.
Sure,
everyone knows who, you know, some of the other greats are. You know, Tim Cass and some of the other guys. You know, but you know he was there. He did a lot. Actually, one other interesting point is that some of the early Arduin material was illustrated by Errol Otis. You know who he is?
No, I don't think I do.
Oh God, yeah, he was one of the. He did a lot. He did some of the early AD&D illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting because it's like it's always interesting to see some of the early works of these people and then see their later works because it's like, wow, you didn't do this. This kind of sucks. And then you're like, you know. Later, you're like, wow, they really improved a lot as an artist.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, sometimes when, you know, and that was the thing back then, back in the day, you know, illustrations for a lot of these products were not that great.
Well, yeah.
I mean, even, you know, and that's the thing. That's why it's like I kind of give a pass to some people who do self-publish on their artwork because it's like, who can afford good artwork?
Oh, no, it's wicked expensive.
You know, and I really... I don't know. It's like people are like, well, you know, in this day and age, it's like, well, everyone has to start somewhere.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And sometimes you're just, it's like, oh, you know, he's my brother. He kind of can draw. So I had him do some artwork for me because I can't pay anybody, you know. And I guess that's why, you know, and the funny thing is for me, it's like, I won't lie. I still like the pencil, the pen and ink drawing style, you know. It's just one of those things. I really still like the black on white drawings, you know, because, yeah, there's no color in there. But I sometimes think I like good pen and ink drawings, to me, give better definition than I've ever seen in color. That's just my opinion.
Sure.
But on the other hand, if you've ever looked through the old DMG, there's a lot of bad pen and ink drawing in there, too.
Uh-huh.
So take your pick.
No, I think I'm right there with you. If you are a small company and you're selling your products at, you know, a small company price, I will never scoff at your bad art, because I understand. I know where you're coming from. If you're trying to sell your product as if it should be competitive with the coast, then you might have some people roll your eyes at you a little bit. You've got to sort of know what you're selling, but it's exceptionally difficult to find. To find quality cheap art, I mean, you see Kickstarters for it, where people are literally doing Kickstarters to just make more art that people can use if they're starting out. You know, you see these Creative Commons art projects, which are really interesting, and
which are interesting, but at the same time, some of the creative, you know, it's some of it's really good art, but it's just like that's not appropriate for 95% of what I need to do.
Sure, exactly. So, you know, but it shows that people understand this need. You know, there's this need for people who are starting off to still have art in their books at some level.
Right.
And it's a toss-up in a lot of ways. If I hate to keep talking about the same thing, but if you look at what we've done in the Call to Assembly or the setting that Gamer Assembly just did, Three Generations of the End, it's all either public domain or Creative Commons art. And some of it's pretty good, and some of it's not. But
hey, at least you admit it. Some of it's not.
Well, that's just the way it is. But in a lot of ways, even the bad art sort reminds me of some of the older products, you know, which I love to grab when I can get my hands on them.
Yeah, I know. That's one of the things that, you know, that's kind of the funny thing is it's like, you know, what's an older product? To me, an older product is something that was made in, like, you know, the '80s, early '80s, and now it's like I don't know what would it be early '90s now for an older product.
Yeah, I don't know if I would. Well, I guess I suppose it all depends on how hard it is to get. That's sort of, if once it's hard to get, it sort of becomes an older product in a way. It's funny like that.
Well, I mean, there's just a lot of older products. I mean, and the truth is you know, especially now, there's not a lot of distribution. You know, you know, like there's not like a warehouse full of stuff that someone's like, all of a sudden, oh my god, we found these in the warehouse. You know, that doesn't really happen anymore.
So. Well, it happens to Paizo every so often gets a bunch of stuff from like, I don't know where their suppliers are. I assume it must be like game stores closing or literally somebody finding a box. If you get the Paizo email newsletter, every so often they're like, hey, we have all this stuff that we did not have before that hasn't existed in 20 years. You should buy it.
Right. Well, I'm just saying, I mean, that's kind of a... Yeah, I mean, it still does happen, but it doesn't happen like it used to, you know.
No, it's not happening all the time, certainly not.
So, we should, I think that's about it for what I wanted to talk about. I mean, I just bring these people up because, you know, most people don't know who they are, and I always want people to be more informed because definitely he, you know, maybe not directly, but he definitely influenced probably the games that we're playing today in some way. So, and like I said, there's definitely a following for him and his Arduin work, and it's still being produced. A new set of rules is actually produced, and the setting is actually being produced by this company called Emperor's Choice. And like I said, there'll be links in the show notes for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. So on the opposite end of the spectrum, we've got what I wanted to talk about today. One of the newest RPG games on the market is the Marvel Heroic role-playing game from Margaret Weiss. It's a Cortex Plus system.
Has that obviously seen print yet, or is that still just PDF?
I believe it is in print now. Okay. Yes.
Because I think there was some confusion at one point. We weren't quite sure.
Well, I think when we last talked about it, it came out in PDF first, and I know exactly what it was. A news item like a month or so ago. The date had changed on Amazon, but not somewhere else. But yes, I am almost positive it's in print. I'm positive it's in print by now. It did go out in PDF first by a week and a half or so, which I thought was an interesting move. And if you were lucky, it was on sale during the drive-through RPGs GM day sale. It was $9 the PDF while it was on sale. It's still only like 13. So if you like what I have to say, I'd go out and grab it. One of the things I definitely want to talk about is narrative combat, which I don't know if that's the official phrase or not. That's the way I'm describing it. I've been playing Marvel for a couple of sessions now with my game group. And if you're a regular listener, you might be shocked because we don't play anything that's not Dungeons and Dragons. A lot of my players sort of scoff at the idea of doing other things. In fact, I couldn't even get them to touch Pathfinder, but I somehow managed to convince them to play the Marvel game. And the Cortex Plus system does not run like D&D at all. One of the biggest shockers is, one, there's not really an attack roll, and two, there's no battle mat to speak of. It doesn't even mention optional rules for using minis, which is funny because there's a Marvel Minis line. And three, did I say there's no initiative? Was that my one? It doesn't matter. Let me move on to the point of narrative combat.
Yeah.
This is all building up to this wonderful point where, you know, without initiative, without the minis and on the table, you're setting up the setting a lot in your words. When a player goes, they describe their actions really without looking at their character sheet. Nice thing about Marvel is that these are all relatively well-known characters, unless you made up your own, in which case you should know your character well. And you can sort of describe what you would do as this character, and you know the character would do, and then you look at your sheet to justify those actions. And so sort of as opposed to the other way around, I feel like when I'm playing D&D, often what we do is we look at what we have in front of us, whether it's 3.5 or AD&D or 4E, and we say, okay, well, I know that I've got an attack roll that lets me hit two people, so that's what I'm going to do. I make my mechanical choice first and then describe it. Marvel really encourages you to make your choice and then back it up with mechanics. And in that way, you sort of shape the scene as you're going. I'll give you an example. In the scene that comes with the game, you're on the superhero prison and all these bad guys are breaking out. So it's kind of chaotic in a way. And the DM has established the scene. You know what's going on. And then you as the hero, say you're Captain America, relatively well-known superhero, you say you want to throw your shield and you want it to bounce. Well, if the DM hasn't established exactly what, you know, the walls look like, that's your job. You know, you're going to say it's going to bounce off the wall that's behind, let's make up a villain, Death Throat, and it's going to come back and hit him in the neck. Well, now we know that there was a wall behind Death Throat, and it doesn't matter that it wasn't really established before. It encourages you to even manipulate the scene in a lot of ways. When you roll a one on any die, people can act on opportunities. And when you act on opportunities, you can bring new resources in the scene, not just the watcher, which is what they call the game master, but the players. You know, they can alter the scene as it's being played out in a way that, in my experience, only the game master can. And I found it really interesting. Have you played any Cortex Plus games?
You know, actually, no, I haven't. I'm lucky that I even got my players to play Savage Worlds, which we're actually doing Solomon Kane right now.
Yep.
And they seem to be really enjoying that, by the way.
So I know Margaret Weiss has had a lot of success with their Smallville line and especially their Leverage line, which I didn't realize Leverage was a particular popular TV show, but when the RPG game came out, a lot of people seemed to be talking about it, which is, it's all about heists, and it's all relatively the same system where...
Well, I've been told there's kind of like two versions of Cortex,
mm-hmm.
and you know, but that's kind of, and I think it's kind of based on the style, the basic style of game that they're going to run, and then yep. each system is further tweaked by whatever game that they're actually trying to produce.
Oh yeah, I didn't mean to misrepresent that. Absolutely, if you're listening to this, that is absolutely my understanding. Where if you're playing Leverage and you're playing Marvel, you can't assume the rules are the same because they're variants off the same core set of rules, and they change that based off what the setting entails. Obviously, a heist game is going to be very different from a big beat 'em up superhero game, but. My understanding is that the core mechanics are the same. You sort of roll a lot of dice. Your opponent rolls a lot of dice. You see whose lot of dice is better. And it's true. no matter what you do in the Marvel superhero games, it seems like you're always rolling at least four dice. You're never just rolling that D20. In fact, the D20 does not exist in this particular game. Which is a lot of fun in and of itself. It reminds me of 3.5. Some of the most fun I've ever had in 3.5 was when the wizard was rolling 24 D6s for some reason. And it brings back that feeling.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. But, you know, the thing that really grabbed me, like I said at the beginning, was this narrative combat, that it really empowers the players to sculpt the scene. And I think it helps keep players engaged. If you're not paying attention, if you're not paying attention to everybody else's turn, you literally don't know what's available for you to interact with. You know, there may be rubble that you didn't hear about, or there may be a motorcycle or a jet plane on the field. Literally, like, they can create a jet plane with their resources if things work out right. So,
well, and you know what's interesting is, what I think is interesting to me is, if you, especially if you look at comics in general, superheroes, that makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, you know, I've played a lot of Champions in my time, which I don't really do much of anymore. Mm-hmm. And the biggest problem is, it's like, okay, I got to draw an entire freaking map of something.
Yep.
You know, it's like, oh, I have this taking place on part of a college campus. Oh my God. In reality, your map board's only so big, right?
Yep.
It's like, in reality, the superheroes could go past your map board and be like 12 map boards away, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, I don't have time to draw all that. So, you know, and so the fights tend to be, and honestly, I think for superheroes tend to be much more, you know, limited. Whereas, you know, with what you're describing, it makes a little more sense because, you know, if you ever look in a comics, it's not like anyone really planned the layout of anything. They just did whatever looked good visually.
Yep. Or even worse, you know, let's take your example to the next level. Never mind a large layout. How about a layout that goes vertical? How hard it is to run a game, you know, on a map that has multiple levels to it? It's ridiculous.
Oh, it's impossible.
But, you know, we were still learning the system when we played our first session. And I had people on the third floor and people on the first floor and people underwater all at the same time. And it did not matter. They made it easy. And in a lot of ways, another cool thing that they worked into the system was they encouraged players to a certain degree to fail. You don't get XP for beating up bad guys. You don't. You get XP for playing out your character's milestones, and you can, you know, sometimes the most XP you'll get is when you quit the team, or when you turn somebody over to the authorities, you know, or when you go off into a berserker rage. You know, things that can be really detrimental, they reward. Well, they also reward some of the positive things, but it, you know, it makes it easy for the DM, the watcher, to set up narrative tension because the players are seeking it out.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot more sense to me. I mean, that's cool. I'm glad. So your players are enjoying that then?
My players are enjoying it. It's very different, so I'm surprised. I thought I'd do one session, maybe two, and we'd move on, but they definitely want to explore this a little bit, so it's great. I think it's a real success for Margaret Weiss, and I can't wait for the new event books to come out.
Yeah, well, you know, here's the thing. It always surprises you know, what your players will enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I remember a while back I did a one-shot, like, 1930 pulp adventure for Savage Worlds, and the players loved it, and it's like, well, you know, I don't really have that much material for that. It was just kind of a one-shot, you know, because one of the things that Pinnacle Entertainment Group does is they actually have like some one-page adventures on their website.
Sure.
And they're, you know, basically, well, now I think you have to pick up the Savage World Deluxe book, because it used to be the Savage World Explorer Edition, but now it's the Deluxe, you know, book, and it's basically the same thing. It's just, but, you know, for a $10 book, you have some adventures you could play. That was the thing with the Explorer Edition, you know, $10 book, and there's some, like, there's some one-page adventures that you can do a couple of one-shots with. So that wasn't a bad price of entry. But, you know, that's the thing. So it's, you know, and so you never know what your players are going to like. And that's why I always encourage people to try other games. There are games that, you know, I'm not interested in, but, you know, hey, the players might be.
Yeah, you never absolutely. Know.
And definitely with something like narrative where it's like you're not having to actually worry about, I mean, how bad are the stats in the game? I mean, what kind of stats do they have?
It's interesting. So there's no strength or charisma or anything. Basically, every character has three quick distinctions about whether they do better by themselves or on a team or with one other person. And in that way, the game encourages you to split the party and bring them back together over and over again. Then they've got a few quick personality quirks that the players can actively use on their turn to, you know, each time they make an action, they can either use a quirk in a positive light for a higher size die or a negative light, which gives them like an opportunity to change things, like a little plot point that they can spend on different actions. And then they've got their powers and their skills. And they've got two power sets, and each one breaks down to a few distinctions. And, you know, they might have 2 to 5 skills. And it runs the gambit. It really does. But it really doesn't matter. It's going to sound funny coming out of my mouth, but power balance in this game really doesn't seem to matter. You could have... I'm trying to think. I'm going to break my setting now. But if you had Superman standing next to Captain America, it would not matter that Superman is infinitely powerful. You would be able to run that game without worrying about it because of the way that these non-combat, this non-initiative works. No matter what, each of them is going to act the, you know, going to have equal opportunities to shine, even if Superman's much faster than Captain America, because it's all sort of dependent on the player's creativity. They'll always find a reason to be able to pitch in. You know, Superman's never going to, you know, clean up the whole scene in 3 seconds. Captain America's always going to get his frame to shine. So if you look at the character creation rules, it's not like, you know, here are your points to build your character. It's, you know, make sure they have powers, make sure they have skills. It doesn't say pick, you know, only 3 equaling up to 20. It really doesn't. it gives you a little bit of notes, like, you know, look at somebody who's similar and, you know, don't give them everything. But
right.
It knows that you're going to have these characters of differing levels, and they built the systems to make sure it's okay.
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's worked out remarkably well. I've had in my home game, I've had, you know, Wolverine. We all know who Wolverine is, who can be a very overpowering character at times. And I've had Iron Man, who can be very overpowering. And then I've had minor characters like some of the more minor X-Men. And it's fine. They all get to do their thing. And it works out very nicely. It doesn't feel cheap. And their example in the book is that when you read a comic book and there's a speedster on the team, and you're going through the pages, it's not like the speedster takes up 9 out of 10 panels on each page. It just doesn't happen like that. Even though they're faster, you accept that in a comic book, they're always going to get sort of an equal portion of the limelight. And it's the gameplay is just like that.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, is there anything else?
No, I think we're good.
All right, well, you know what? We're actually at the... place where we actually ask you guys to send us your comments, because we have quite a few ways you can send it to us. You can obviously send us an email at info@rpgcircus.com. We'd love if you would actually call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-643-6322. That is 1-888-643-6322. You can Twitter us at @RPGCircus. You can send us messages on the RPG Circus Facebook page, which you can post something to our wall, or just ask us questions. I've been trying to post a little more there every so often. Mm-hmm. So trying to activate that a little bit. Unfortunately, the only problem with Facebook is that the Facebook pages, the layout is going to change on the 30th of March, no matter who you are and whether you like it or not. The preview I've seen, I'm not entirely happy with, but we will see where that goes. So, any closing comments before we just kind of pack it up?
No. If I don't talk to you guys before then, I hope to see some of our listeners at PAX East.
Yes, when is that?
I'm sorry?
When is that?
PAX East is Easter weekend. It's the 6th to the 8th. I think I actually lied to you guys last time. I told our listeners that I would be doing a panel at 12:30 on Saturday. It turns out that Tracy Hurley, also known as Sarah Dark Magic, one of the hosts of The Tomb Show, has a very similarly titled panel on Saturday. Our panel is on Friday night at 7. So, if you looked me up in the schedule, you would have seen that. So, Boston, Easter weekend, Friday night, I'll be there. I hope to see you guys too.
All right. Well, there you go. I sort of think that kind of wraps things up for now.
Mm-hmm.
And, hope Marsh will be able to make it next time. That is not the way that's supposed to end, but hey, Creative RPG Circus is a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0, and for more information, please visit creativecommons.org.